This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The weather has been acting extraordinarily recently. At least it seems that way. This winter was marked by heavy snow after heavy snow in the Northeast. Then just weeks ago, the South was plagued by a string of tornadoes. In fact, there were 305 tornadoes reported in one day, and I believe that's the greatest number ever reported, along with the most powerful single tornado ever recorded. The destruction is massive, and the death toll, shocking. And while this was happening in the South, other parts of the country have been inundated with rain and floodwaters. So we're going to talk about all of this weather activity with some meteorologists this hour to find out if this is just a fluke or if it's being seen as more of a permanent change in weather patterns. But first, I want to bring an eyewitness to the destruction caused by those recent tornadoes into the conversation for just a few minutes. Chris Clackham, who fills in for me on this program on occasion, is a national correspondent for the NBC News Channel located here in Charlotte. And he recently spent time in Pleasant Grove, Alabama. That's about 40 miles from Tuscaloosa, which got a lot of the brunt of the storm. Chris, welcome to the program again.
Thanks, Mike. Nice talking to you.
How did you end up being sent to Pleasant Grove, Alabama? And what kind of a place, I hate to say was that, but was that?
Well, it was just this idyllic setting, a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, only about 8 or 9 miles as the crow flies from downtown Birmingham. And it was at the tail end of a tornado that, the same tornado that had hit Tuscaloosa, about an hour, 45 minutes earlier on Wednesday, April 27th, you know, just over a week ago. This tornado, according to the National Weather Service now, has been confirmed to have been on the ground for some 80 miles, moving from the southwest to the northeast, from southwest of Tuscaloosa towards Birmingham, staying on the ground an unprecedented 80 miles, because that is just not the normal nomenclature, if you will, of a southern tornado. Most of the tornadoes in the south, as the weather experts will tell you, kind of hopscotch. They go up, they come down, and they come down randomly. Rarely do they stay on the ground, and rarely do they stay on the ground this long.
You sent me a still photograph of yourself standing in Pleasant Grove yesterday, kind of amidst the destruction, and it actually told me more than the moving pictures that you see on television, because I could actually look at the picture for more than a nanosecond and see what you were in the middle of, which is virtually nothing. I mean, you could tell that there had been a neighborhood there, but there was virtually nothing there anymore. And you told me yesterday on the phone, because both you and I have covered tornadoes and the aftermath, that you've never seen anything like the destruction you saw in Pleasant Grove.
Nothing like this. As it turns out, we picked Pleasant Grove because it was another residential area that was extremely hard hit, much like Tuscaloosa. By the way, that tornado that came through Tuscaloosa and then later on through Pleasant Grove was an EF4. And for the weather geeks out there, that they know that that means that it had winds of 190 miles an hour or more for a sustained period of time. It was a residential section of Pleasant Grove that got hit, and this particular area that I'm standing up over is sort of a valley part of Pleasant Grove, and there had to be 250 homes in this one section that were obliterated, Mike. I mean, just obliterated, wiped off. There's nothing left. Recovery for the folks of Pleasant Grove means that they're going to have to start all over because there is nothing to build upon.
You talk to a lot of folks in that area who are obviously stunned and picking up the pieces of the wreckage, but you also met and talked with an 80-year-old couple who were watching television with their grandchild, and they saw a forecaster on television who essentially saved their lives.
He did indeed.
Talk to me about that.
The meteorologist with one of the TV stations in Birmingham was on the air. This was a wave of storms that was moving across the state of Alabama. This was a 300-mile-wide storm system, an extremely violent storm system that created at least 175 tornadoes on Wednesday alone. over a 48-hour period, about 305 tornadoes. And it spawned this particularly violent tornado there in Pleasant Grove and earlier in Tuscaloosa. And this couple had been watching television in the it was a house with a basement, fortunately with a basement. They had been watching television, watching the weather, as people are apt to do. And the meteorologist came on and said, if there is ever a time when you need to listen to me and to get to safety immediately, it is right now. And he said, this tornado is massive, and here's what it has already done to Pleasant Grove. Sure enough, they followed his instructions, grabbed their granddaughter, went to the basement of their house. It was a partially below-ground basement, and that saved their lives. Because then, literally within 2 minutes, I would say, according to them, the tornado came over and leveled the top floor of the house. Just leveled it all the way to the ground.
It's an extraordinary thing. We're going to post the picture that you sent us of yourself standing in Pleasant Grove on our website at WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks if people want to take a look at it. Because as I say, you really do get almost more of what it was like to sit there and stare at the picture as opposed to the moving pictures that you see on TV. Chris, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
You bet, Mike.
Chris Clackham, who is a national correspondent for the NBC News Channel and frequent guest host. In fact, you'll be here on Monday for me. Joining us for the remainder of the program are a team of meteorologists, because just like on television, you have to have a team of meteorologists to talk about the weather. Katie Virtue is part of the team at Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
And she joins us in our Spirit Square studio with Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist for WCNC 6 News. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Neil Dixon is a general forecaster for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Weather Service. He joins us by phone from Greenville, Spartanburg, which is where Charlotte gets its weather, much to our chagrin. Welcome, Neil. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning.
Now, talk about this tornado we were just talking about. It was on the ground, as Chris said, for 80 miles, and mostly in the south. Tornadoes, as he said, hopscotch. They're on the ground, they lift themselves up, they plop themselves down maybe a few blocks, a few miles later, they do it again, and they do it again, and they do it again. What was it about this tornado in this storm system that made it, A, so wide, and B, consistently on the ground for 80 miles? I don't know who to ask that. Katie, go ahead.
Well, it was an extraordinarily long-lived supercell. In fact, even after it left Alabama, it crossed into Georgia, the same supercell put down a tornado all the way into western North Carolina. It was the kind of supercell you'd see in the center part of the country, in Tornado Alley. You'd see these more often, of course, Oklahoma and Texas. And as to a reason why, I'm not sure. I think in terms of the atmospheric parameters that day, just kind of the right details lined up to keep that storm alive for such a long period of time.
Neil, I guess you guys follow this even more in depth than local TV weather meteorologists, because that's your job. Maybe you can shed some light on this particular system.
Well, the storm developed out ahead of a cold front, and what was unprecedented about this storm is that we had a widespread wind shear, all across Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas. So the storm had an environment that was very suitable for a long-lived tornado, as it tracked to the east. It just didn't find conditions that were actually weaker than where it actually initiated. So it was able to become very well organized, and that led to, a track over 80 miles. And, what was really kind of startling about this storm is that its path width was a mile and a half wide. Now, that's very, very uncommon.
Now, you guys on television, when I watch you, Brad, you talk about weak fronts, strong fronts, unsettled atmospheric conditions. And you guys obviously are getting all these from readings that you're getting from computers and weather balloons and God knows what all. What does all that mean?
Well, I mean, there's so much data available to us. And on this day in particular, and even on the 16th when we had the tornadoes here in North Carolina, we have these composite indices we look at, which take into account instability as well as wind shear.
And they're coming from where, that information?
They're coming from the National Weather Service primarily, but they're also coming from institutions. You got a lot of universities developing this, even foreign entities. I mean, some of the models I look at are from Canada, from Europe. All of this data combined is really what helps us put the forecast together. And as Neil was alluding to, and I know Katie would attest to this, those two events, the wind shear in particular, something we look at is these helicity values, which typically if we have helicity values, which is basically the twisting of the wind, mm-hmm. in the 1 to 200s, that's hot. On this day, we had 6, 7, 800. Numbers I'd never seen, and you combine that with instability that was off the charts, you had the perfect storm.
What does instability mean to you?
Well, instability is basically when you have really warm, moist air at the surface on top or below really cold air aloft. And that instability allows for lift. It allows for a parcel of air to start at the surface and continue to go up into the atmosphere. And when you get a lot of instability with a lot of wind shear, you get rotating updrafts, which then produce tornadoes. So one of the indices that I look at in particular is called Energy Helicity Index. It's called EHI, which takes two of the things we look at. We just talked about wind shear and instability. Typically in the 1 to 2, 3 range, we would be like, hey, we're going to have significant tornadoes. This particular storm in Alabama had a 12.1, which if you look at the scattergrams for some of the big events, that's almost double what the 99 tornado was in Oklahoma City. I mean, just unprecedented levels. And I heard, I can't remember who quoted this, but I heard, you know, this was a great example of wind shear of a blizzard and instability of a tropical system all in the same location.
Which leads me to the question that is on everybody's mind, I think, because we look at these enormous storms so far this spring, and we haven't even gotten into summer yet. We look at the incredible snowfall in the Northeast. They didn't know where to put the snow after a while. There was so much of it, and it came week after week after week. Neil, are we witnessing some sort of change in weather patterns that we can say, yep, it's actually changing? It's not just a fluke. It's not that's not just this winter. It's a change.
Well, I certainly hope not. You know, this winter we had a La Nina. We also had a, you know, very progressive pattern as far as the polar jet kind of dipping to the south, which happened pretty routinely during the winter. And when that happens, you know, storms are you know, rapidly deepening over the Midwest and then tracking up to the Northeast and resulting in all the frequent snowstorms. That pattern pretty much continued into the spring, and that's why you know so far in the month of April, you know, we've seen an unprecedented number of tornado events.
Mm-hmm.
And the good news is it looks like the La Nina is going to become more and more neutral as we head into June, and that neutral pattern may continue into the summer. So that may help kind of turn off the faucet of all these frequent storms and, you know, lead us with looking into the tropical weather season.
So I'm going to talk about La Nina and El Nino a little bit in depth later on in the program, but I was flipping around during one of the recent storm systems that came through Charlotte, and everybody was on the air doing weather. And everybody was looking pretty serious about this. And I just happened to be landing on Channel 9 when Steve Udelson said the Weather Service had given a particular name to what was happening out there, and it was called a PDS, a particularly dangerous storm. And he said, I've been here for a long time. I've never, ever seen this before. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Islamic Society of Greater Charlotte, presenting an open house and keynote speech, Should We Fear Islam, this Saturday at 6:45 p.m. Details at 704-361-7771. Well, we've come a long way from the days when having a learning disability meant that a child might not get the education that he or she deserved. These days, we know more about learning disabilities, and Charlotte has a school that gives students the individual attention they need to succeed. We'll talk about that Monday at 9. Chris Clackham will be here. You've already heard him this morning talking about tornadoes, but he'll be here Monday at 9 to take you through that.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama rules out releasing photos of Osama bin Laden. The White House and top lawmakers discuss a deal to raise the federal deficit. And key candidates skip the first GOP debate.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting around the table this morning at Spirit Square with Brad Panovich, Chief Meteorologist at WCNC 6 News, Katie Virtue, Meteorologist with Channel 9, Eyewitness News, and Neil Dixon, General Forecaster of from the National Weather Service. I mentioned the PDS that all the forecasters were talking about a couple of weeks ago, the particularly dangerous situation, which I said Steve Udelson had said he'd never seen before in this area of the country. And it doesn't happen very often anywhere, does it?
No, it doesn't happen very often at all. Maybe one, two, or three times a year, and usually in Tornado Alley in the center of the country. So out here, when you have that PDS, it's telling us that it's not just a regular tornado watch. It's saying that not only will there be tornadoes, but there will likely be a huge event and very dangerous high-level tornadoes, you know, EF4, EF5. The threat is there, and something Brad touched on a few minutes ago, that we had such high indices that we look at. You look at things like the rotation of the wind, and a day ahead of the storm, we could look at that and say, these indices are off the charts. We have a huge risk. And we could pinpoint where the highest risk was in central Alabama, northern Alabama. But at the same time, you still can't stop the destruction.
Right.
You know, it was very frustrating for meteorologists to hear.
Off the air, you were both saying that the National Weather Service and TV meteorologists were very, very successful in incredibly accurately predicting exactly where the problems would be with tornadoes, and still hundreds of people died out there in Alabama.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the statistics, it's unbelievable. The average lead time on those warnings were 24 to 26 minutes, and something like 90% of the tornadoes were in a warned area.
Is that because people didn't get the warning because they weren't watching television, or because it's a populated area and they had no place to go?
A little bit of both, but I think one of the things we found out in Alabama was early in the morning there was a big squall line, a derecho came through, a big windstorm. It knocked out power to a lot of the folks in northern Alabama. It actually knocked out a couple of the National Weather Service NOAA weather radio transmitters. So by the evening, when the second round of storms came in, the tornadoes, there was about 200,000 to 300,000 people without power. So many of them may have not gotten the warning at all. Right. The skies cleared. Maybe they thought the first batch moved through. There's a whole societal kind of impact thing with severe weather where we find, and I know Neil could probably talk about this, the Weather Service looks like this quite a bit. What kind of wording works? What call to actions make people actually heed the warnings?
Well,
because
that PDS got me, and seriously, the expression on Steve Udelson's face was so serious. I mean, you believed, because sometimes I got to say that it's, and I've been involved in this, that sometimes you look like you may be crying wolf, or yeah, it's going to be serious for somebody up there, but not for me. It looked really serious, just the expression on his face. I believed him. I even got my weather radio out and stuck it on the night table because he said do that, so I did it.
It's dangerous when they're overnight and these storms.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing. These most damaging storms in Alabama happened late in the afternoon.
Yeah.
It happened when everyone was awake. Mm-hmm. Perhaps people were at work. But it wasn't like it was the middle of the night. So we would hope that as many people as possible were getting the warning.
Neil Dixon, talk about the importance and how you word things so that people will take you seriously.
We do have enhanced wording for, conditions just like this. If there was a confirmed tornado or a large violent tornado on the ground, our warnings would contain wording that would say, this is a tornado emergency. Mm-hmm. Take cover now. And, that really gets people's flags, flying high when they hear wording like that. But, you know, when we go out and do storm surveys, I make it a point to go out and interview the people that were impacted by the storm, ask them if they heard the warning, if they took any action. And, you know, a lot of things are being revealed, you know, as far as what it takes for a person to take cover. And one of the things is they prefer to have the information coming from various sources. They like having it coming from the TV, having it coming from the weather radio. And then one of the big things now is social media. You know, they'll get a tweet, you know, from a friend or a family member saying, you know, this looks pretty serious. You need to take cover now.
And plus, you guys in the TV world are tweeting about the weather to people who follow you, correct?
Yeah, Brad does Twitter, has a lot of followers. I know at Channel 9, we primarily are Facebook.
I have to ask you how, in the midst of all, because I've been involved in breaking news stories, so you are literally frantic to get the information in and to get it out on the air. How do you have time to deal with Twitter and Facebook at the same time?
You have to make time. And here's the reason why. Especially on that Saturday afternoon, not everybody's watching TV. A lot of people are on the lake. They're at their kid's softball game. They're at their kid's soccer game. I think the days, we understand it as meteorologists because weather happens 24/7. It doesn't happen on a news cycle. So as a meteorologist, yeah, you have to give the information to the public by any means necessary. And for me, it's Facebook, Twitter, radio, TV, text messaging, whatever way you can. And the other thing is you just know. I mean, even I know that not everyone's watching me. I know they're watching Katie or they're watching Steve or they're watching Eric or they're watching, you know, News 14. When it becomes severe weather, our jobs are more about safety and getting information out than, yeah, it is about competition between stations or who's first with this and that. It's really about getting information. So I will use any means necessary to get it out. And I've been on the air before in tornado coverage and literally said, hey, I am typing a tweet out right now because I know that there are people that aren't watching me that have to get this information. What if you lose power? You got to get that to people's smartphones. That's what you have to do.
So we have ways of getting the message out that we didn't have 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I would imagine, Neil, that you have ways of predicting what's going to happen that we didn't have 10 years ago. In other words, could you have been able to predict with the kind of accuracy that the Weather Service predicted the tornadoes in Alabama or even the line of tornadoes that came through North Carolina 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah, we certainly invest a lot of time and energy and training, and that's looking at events like this. I mean, this event will go down into our training log for years to come. So, you know, just training the meteorologists of what to look for and working on case studies and, you know, we even have a weather event simulator where we can, you know, play this in real time again, and our warning forecasters can go back and practice issuing warnings and look at the actual impact of these storms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the numerical simulations or the models are becoming more and more refined. There's more and more science being put into them. And as computing power increases, our resolution, you know, is dropping from, you know, what was a few years ago, 10 to 20 miles resolution down to, there's one model now that's down to a 1 kilometer resolution. So that's even getting more finely detailed.
Is that how you TV people are able to essentially show us the weather over our neighborhood? Seriously, with your you can show us exactly where things are, right down to the street number almost.
That resolution is a huge issue when you're talking about small-scale events. In the grand scheme of things, thunderstorms are tiny. You know, a computer model as of now will not necessarily be able to tell you exactly where in a county that thunderstorm is going to pop up, but it can give you maybe a 2-county-wide view or something like that, and perhaps a day ahead of the event. And that is a huge resource for us that they didn't have, you know, like you said, 5 or 10 years ago. And so when we focus in on the new changes in the computer models, you're really looking at that tight spatial resolution. It's not no longer talking about a system that's covering the South. Now you are saying we can look down actually at your county, your neighborhood, and give you a good estimate of when this will arrive or when this will impact you.
You know, Charlotte is not known for its weather. we go through whole winters and not get a flake.
Yeah. Which is fine by me.
Of snow. This is not Buffalo. Yeah. But we do have violent storms in the spring and in the summer as the weather begins to shift. And that's when you guys really become important. I don't know how to ask this question, but I mean, do you feel like wallpaper the rest of the year, but then suddenly you become vital?
Well, you're right, and I tell people this all the time. I think where we make our money is severe weather coverage because it's the most vital thing we do, especially as a TV station. And you really, when you get that license from the FCC, you know, it always has that. You're supposed to serve the public interest. Well, to me, severe weather coverage is the definition right. of serving the public interest. Now, some people don't like that. You mentioned sometimes we're on, and it's in a county that people don't understand that we cover. And that's always tough, but I'm always going to err on the side of safety. I will take 1,000 calls of people complaining to me for cutting into their favorite show before I want to take one call saying, hey, my house was destroyed or my son and daughter was injured and you weren't on the air. I would rather take that 1,000 complaints of cutting into a show than
well,
the one.
I was going to bring that up much later in the program, but since you brought it up, let's talk about it because people do get annoyed because the coverage areas of the TV stations in Charlotte are large and much larger than the city of Charlotte and even the county of Mecklenburg. You cover multiple counties, and sometimes in thunderstorm situations, a severe, bad thunderstorm can be affecting Hickory, for instance, and have no effect on us whatsoever. It's a sunny, bright, nice day here. And yet you feel the need to cut into normal programming and go with extended weather coverage. People have to understand why you're doing that. Are there policies in place for you to know? I mean, who makes that decision? Do you, as the on-duty meteorologist, make that decision? Do you have to go to a higher-up? How does it work?
We have overarching policies that we develop not only with our news department but with our programming department, in terms of, say, a tornado warning when we know it's the most dangerous situation. That's when we're more likely to stay on the air for a long period of time. And they allow us on a daily basis to make that decision. How significant is this storm? How dangerous? How threatening? And then we can go to our news director, we can go to our programming director and say, we need to cut in, we need to stay on for this long, or we don't need to stay
because
on.
Because the average person doesn't understand that when you go on and you stay on, not only are you interrupting programming, you're preempting commercials, mm-hmm. which keep the lights on at these places. So that's a major decision.
Yeah, and just like Katie said, we have overarching policies, but every situation's different. And I'm pretty lucky that my boss really makes it my decision. He knows I'm the chief meteorologist, the expert in the field. If I feel like we need to go on before a warning is issued, I will. I will go off the air before it's canceled and moved out if I feel like it's not a dangerous situation. But you bring up a good point, Mike. I mean, we get these complaints and people think we do it because it's fun or we're doing it because right. we want to be on TV. We literally lose thousands, if sometimes tens of thousands of dollars in revenue. We have to pay overtime to all the staff that has to come in and cover these events. This is something that actually costs us right. money as opposed to making us money.
Because behind every person on television is probably 5 or 10 more people mm-hmm. who are working to make them able to do what they do on camera. Having worked in the TV newsroom, I know that the TV sets in the newsroom are all set on everybody else. I mean, when I used to work at Channel 3, we had Channel 9 and Channel 6 on all the time, and we watched to see what you were doing. Is there influence? Like if you look up and Katie's on television in extended coverage, or you look up and Brad's on television in extended coverage, do you say, "Oh, I got to do this. We got to do this now." is that how it works?
Oh, actually, for us, we do most of our work in the studio, and that's where our computers are. That's where we're working.
So you don't see.
We actually don't really see what's going on with everyone else, and so it is kind of it's our internal decision, generally speaking. And sometimes, you know, maybe a producer in the newsroom will pop their head in and say, "Oh, so and so's doing this or that." But, as Brad said, at that time, you can't let that influence you. It doesn't.
You don't have these commercial pressures, Neil Dixon, at the National Weather Service. Your job is just to get the word out. And what tools do you have at your disposal? You have the weather radio. You have the information that goes in a stream to television stations, to radio stations to get the word out. But you really have no control over the final word getting out, do you?
Yeah, like you said, we have our we have the weather radio, we have our webpage, and but when it comes time to warning decision, you know, we have two primary tools. One of them is our weather radar, the Doppler radar, and we have two of them that we actually use. One is at outside of our door here in Greenville. The other one is actually north of the Charlotte Airport. It's the Charlotte FAA radar, and we're able to use that. It also has Doppler capabilities. And our other primary tool is our trained weather spotters. We spend a lot of time going out to communities and training volunteer spotters of, you know, what to look for in a storm and how to report it to us. And their reports are very vital to us when we're in warning operations mode.
And local television has been making use of that, too, people sending in their pictures from their camera phones, et cetera, and calling in to say that I spotted a funnel cloud and here's where it was, et cetera. And yet there was an article in the paper this morning about an individual, I think in North Carolina, who was standing in a parking lot looking at the tornado, saying, oh, my God, it's coming, and filming it, taping it on his phone, recording it on his phone, and then being swept up in it because he was covering the tornado.
Yeah.
And the National Weather Service guy talking in there says, you've got to understand that these are dangerous storms. Don't stand there and look at them. Get the heck out of there. Is that a problem, Neil? Is it becoming a problem?
Well, there's certainly a, I guess, a community of people that want to storm chase or go out and get video for whatever reason. Yeah, our message is consistently safety. You know, don't stand outside risking yourself to get hit by strong winds or falling debris or lightning strikes. I mean, lightning strikes is the primary hazard with thunderstorms. So, you know, our message is safety. You know, get inside, stay inside until the storm passes.
According to, now I'm going to get back to the overarching weather patterns and not just how you cover this stuff, but according to one report I read, there were a couple of factors that are making this year more active so far with regard to the weather than even last year. It was we had more active severe weather year compared to normal and to last year because of warm water in the Gulf of Mexico, which is warmer than last year, and one of the strongest, and you've already mentioned this, La Nina patterns in recorded history. You all agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Then talk to us about La Nina and El Nino. What are they? Why do they change? And what is their impact on our weather? Because these are both things that happen in the Pacific Ocean.
Correct.
You have to remember that the entire atmosphere is connected. The entire world is connected. And there's that classic phrase from chaos theory that the butterfly beats its wings in China and a tornado forms in Kansas. And in some respects, that is true on some levels. The ocean churning in the Pacific, it can change the weather patterns over the United States of America. And that's why we look at what we call global oscillations, the changes in the air patterns over as far away as, you know, Tahiti affecting, or, you know, off the coast of Chile affecting our weather. And it makes it harder to pinpoint perhaps what an individual storm is doing in terms of global climate change, because we're seeing climate change on a daily basis over the globe. So it's hard to pinpoint what's going on in a particular year to what's going on for a long span.
When you say, and I have 30 seconds, when you say you're seeing global climate change across the world, what are you talking about? Individual areas where things are getting worse or better, or warmer or hotter?
Well, the natural oscillations, the natural changes perhaps in the ocean waters that are impacting our weather patterns, that stuff happens all the time. So it's very hard to say how is that happening over a decade or 100
right.
years.
We have to take a break. I want to come back and follow up on that because that's something that people need to know about. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE listeners and Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP, a Charlotte-headquartered CPA and advisory firm with a 79-year history of resources and relationships, serving clients in the South, Mid-Atlantic, and throughout the U.S. Details at dhgllp.com. It's Friday. That means it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 and 11, the National Hour first, the International Hour second. Kathy Kay is in for Diane today. and a panel of journalists. She and a panel of journalists will talk about President Obama ruling out releasing the photos of Osama bin Laden, the White House and top lawmakers discussing a deal to raise the federal debt ceiling, and key candidates skipping the first GOP debate. That and more, and your calls are welcomed as well, as they are now, about the weather. 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Getting the latest news headlines is never really a problem. The real challenge, though, is finding out what's behind those headlines. And that's why you listen to Morning Edition. I'm Scott Graff. Join me weekday mornings for the context and perspective that give meaning to the day's headlines. Wake up to Morning Edition from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. Neil Dixon joins us. He's the general forecaster for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which runs the National Weather Service. He joins us by phone from Greenville-Spartanburg. Brad Panovich is chief meteorologist for Channel 6, and Katie Virtue is a meteorologist for Channel 9. And Eyewitness News. And we were talking just before the break about La Nina and El Nino and about local climate change. I want to be clear about this because people are saying global warming, climate change, blah, blah, blah. And we have noticed changes in our climate here in North Carolina, just as they have noticed it elsewhere. But they are not necessarily warmer. They could be colder. Yep. Are you saying that climate change happens everywhere all the time, that there is no norm, or that we're seeing more of this?
I personally, there's no such thing as normal in weather. Mm-hmm. And that word we use way too often, because even when we say the normal high, it's really not the normal high. It's the average high. It's taking all the highs and lows, or all the highs for that date over the history of the record book, and averaging it out. It may have never been that actual temperature on that date, but if you have a bunch of really hot days and really cold days, that's the average temperature.
Years ago, I used to talk to an AccuWeather meteorologist every day on the radio. And I asked him one day, do you believe in global warming? And he said no. Now, this was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Has the opinion of experts, meteorologists, et cetera, has it changed? Neil, do you believe we are experiencing global warming?
Well, I think if you go back and you look at the records and the trends, the Earth is warming. I think the great debate lies in what's causing the warming. But, you know, so global scale, the Earth has been warming. And, you know, there's been periods in history where the Earth has been cooling. This is not very well understood about, you know, what triggers, you know, that phase change from cooling to warming.
And we take the politics out of this. And, and the politics comes in when we say, well, we're causing it. People are causing it. But just take that out. Could this be part of some grand cycle if weather is cyclic? The Earth is warming now, but it will cool later. Is that what we're saying?
I would agree. I absolutely believe that because I mean, it's all cyclical.
So when the world warms, as you say, Neil, that it is warming now, would that account for the fact that we got incredible snowstorms in the Northeast last winter, and we're getting incredible tornadoes in the South this spring? Would that account for part of that?
Well, I think the whole environment is more complex than that. Certainly, if you have warmer air, it's going to have more capability of holding moisture. That moisture and warmth makes the atmosphere more unstable, you know, causing stronger storms. But, I can't say that we can look at the month of April, where we had a major wind event on April 4th, a monster hail event on April 9th, and then the tornado outbreak in late April, and say that that's, a direct effect from global warming.
Now, years ago, we talked a lot about El Nino because we were going through a strong period of El Nino, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong because I don't really remember, that was a period when we were in severe drought here. Is that right? Is that what happens here in this
most
part of
likely
the world?
We would be in a La Nina with a drought here. That's typically when we get our
La Nina.
Yes.
Okay,
so the last strong La Nina, 2007.
Now, but I'm specifically talking about El Nino. So maybe we're getting a lot of rain. Is that what we're doing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We would have a really wet fall, winter, and spring.
I couldn't remember it. I just remember talking about it. But I had never heard of La Nina. That seems to be a new phrase, and it's the reverse. La Niña and El Niño are opposite sides of the same coin. They are the trough and the apogee and the perigee of the wave, right?
Absolutely.
So what is La Niña? And are we in a La Niña now?
Well, we're coming out of one right now. We had a really strong one the end of last summer into the winter, and that pretty much, you know, gave us the crazy winter we had, and it's also responsible for the active spring we're having. But there's other oscillations. La Niña is a cooling of the equatorial Pacific off the west coast of South America. But as Neil was alluding to, there's other oscillations. There's the PDO, there's the North Atlantic Oscillation, there's the Arctic Oscillation. And this winter, we kind of had all those go negative that could have produced heavy snow and cold in the eastern half of the country. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that sometimes it's hard to forecast. You can forecast La Niña is going to be strong. But if they all go the one direction at the right time, you can end up with this kind of crazy weather we had this spring and into, you know, now into the summer. The only good news is it looks like the La Niña is going to weaken, which will hopefully start to shift the polar jet back north, which will keep the wind shear out of the south.
That's the other thing we should talk about, the jet stream, because that played a role in this recent spate of tornadoes. The jet stream moves from, west to east across the world and at really high speeds. And occasionally it will slow or speed up, and occasionally it will dip further south than it normally would. Where is it today, for instance?
In a regular season, it's going to shift from north to south, depending on whether you're in winter or summer. But it's that extra shift that comes along with perhaps El Niño or La Niña that causes the biggest difference. And right now, for the time being, it's shifting back to the north. It's bringing us a little bit of a break from the spate of storms. That's something we're going to look at on a daily basis. But on a larger basis, when you look at a whole season, you can say in an El Niño episode, that jet stream's coming directly across the southern half of the U.S. Okay. It's going to be the feed of moisture across the south into the Carolinas. And La Niña can be the opposite, where it's farther north and we can have perhaps a longer spates of dry weather and we're not dealing with a constant stream of storms.
Neil, how do you measure all this at the National Weather Service? What instruments do you use? How do you know where the jet stream is, how fast it's moving, whether it's going up or down, north or south? How do you know where the cells are, the thunderstorms. So how do you know all this stuff, fronts and stuff?
We spend a vast majority of our budget and time actually observing the weather, not doing any forecasting, but just observing the weather. The Weather Service, half of the offices twice a day release weather balloons. They travel up about 20 miles high, and, while they're traveling upward, they're sending us, temperature information, dew point, and the wind. So That's our primary tool of detecting where, the jet stream is or to gauge how unstable the atmosphere is. There's also an instrument packet that's on the tail end of large aircraft. As they're taking off and landing and at a cruising altitude, you're sending back weather information.
Commercial aircraft? Are you talking about like U.S. Airways and Delta?
That's right, because, weather to them is very important. So they are, They're a partner in this whole thing about observing the weather and sending the conditions back to us.
There's
weather satellites too that we can look at different channels to see the moisture content or judge the speed of the atmosphere.
Neil mentioned the word forecasting, which is something I want to get into in a second, but I have a lot of people who want to talk to you. So let me bring in some people into the conversation. We'll begin with somebody who identifies themselves as Dr. Galley in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, thanks for taking my call. I have a suggestion to improve the penetration of the early warning system when the power goes out and for rural areas and such.
Okay.
And if I could just set this up. A number of years ago, I had just left the Linghua Temple, the Buddhist temple in town, and I was driving away and flipped the radio on, and they said something about a tornado warning. And I couldn't find anything else on the radio about it, so I had to go back to the temple to watch the TV. So my suggestion is that, in the old days we had the air raid sirens. So why not have a local, regional, and national procedure to have the law enforcement sirens and the EMS sirens all go off in an alert, with a specific type of a signal so that it would combine with the citizen drills and education. Like the monthly testing on the emergency radio system.
Right.
That's only good if you got the radio on. So But if, you know, if all of the police officers or the sheriffs or the EMS had their sirens go off at the same time with a specific type of warning, and then the radio stations broadcasting all the radio stations broadcasting repetitively these warnings, then I think there would be a lot more penetration and maybe the chance of saving some lives.
Do we have any kind of system like that in this area? Any kind of system like that? Outside of the television stations and the emergency broadcast system, do we have any?
The only thing I'm aware of is both of the Duke nuclear power plants have a siren system.
But if
they
go off, you think it's a nuclear
problem.
Yeah,
but they also set them off for tornado warnings.
Okay.
Which is nice, but it's only if you live within the perimeter of those areas.
Interesting idea, Doctor. Thank you for your call. Let me go to Lake Norman and DJ. Welcome. You're on WFAE.
Good morning to you, Mike, Neil, Katie, Brad. Is Chris still with you guys?
No.
He's gone. Okay.
He had to go to work.
I just want to say that those of us with satellite television, Brad and Katie, you're doing a really good job, except, bam, now that the clouds thicken and it's getting dangerous, there goes my television signal, okay? And today, Brad mentioned earlier about using multimedia to get the word out. People, we are like the most connected society in the world, and yet we seem to be, in a lot of ways, disconnected from some of these warnings. You know, if I'm on Facebook or just on my email, I don't get anything on my computer that tells me this is happening. And, you know, okay, I don't tweet, and I know you can reach a lot of people that way. But, you know, I think your previous caller about radio stations no longer, I mean, they run that EA emergency action notification thing, and then they go back to whatever they were doing. And, you know, we've got a lot more we can accurately pinpoint a lot of these things now with Doppler radar and all. And one last point. I'm in a slab house, and this will be a question. I'm in a slab house. If we got an EF4 coming through here or an EF5, and I'm just in a slab house, I saw the destruction in Alabama. Mm-hmm. How in the world am I going to survive that in the middle bathroom?
Let's talk about that, because we don't have basements here. Even if you're not on a slab, you're probably on a crawl space, and that means the house will just get picked up. Where do you go? Where do you go in the house?
I mean, really the option would
Why is a bathroom safe?
Oftentimes with the pipes through the walls, the construction of the bathroom, you have the plumbing
but
that extends
the
house.
But the pipes are now PVC. They're not metal anymore. So, I mean, seriously, why is that safe, really? Is it safer?
It is your best and primarily only option when you don't have a basement.
Yeah.
That would be really the best you can do.
We should point out that I saw out of Ringgold, Georgia, northern Georgia, south of Chattanooga, I saw a house that was hit by an EF4 tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And the only room standing was the bathroom. The roof was gone. The door was gone. But the only room, this splintered house, was the bathroom. Now, EF5, he's absolutely right. There was people in Oklahoma City in basements that died in an EF5, but EF5s make up 0.1% of all tornadoes. So it's a very rare event. And that's the type of situation where when we give these warning, you know, these procedures, it's for 99.9% of all tornadoes. The 0.1%, in some cases, you have to be underground or out of the path.
And if you're in a car, what do you do?
This is controversial. I don't know how Katie feels about this, but I know the Red Cross says one thing, the Weather Service says another. I think in this day and age, I think if you're in a car, my preference would be for you to try to drive to a sturdy structure first.
But not an underpass.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
The biggest, and a lot of people don't realize, the biggest danger with tornadoes can be the shrapnel, mm-hmm. can be the materials in the air. When you see that tornado, it is a funnel cloud filled with tree branches and metal.
One of the reasons, thank you for your call, DJ, one of the reasons that we had so much loss of life in Alabama was because it was a populated area. It did not go over farmland. It went through neighborhoods with lots of houses. And it went through a city.
Yep.
We don't hear much about tornadoes going through cities. It is possible for a tornado to go through a metropolitan downtown area, right?
Absolutely.
If you're living in a high-rise condominium on the 30th floor and you see this thing coming, what do you do? Where do you go?
Same thing. I'd get as low as possible, or at least to an interior part of that building, because likely what's going to happen is the shell of the building is going to be destroyed. In Fort Worth, I believe it was late 90s, the Xerox building got hit by a tornado. And I saw the pictures of one side of the building getting hit by debris, breaking the glass, And the wind blew through the building, blew all the office furniture out the other side of the building through the windows. Now, the shell of the building is intact, but the outer exterior, the facade and the windows are broken.
A couple of emails quickly here. There's a running joke among the public regarding meteorologists about how they're able to be correct only half the time and still keep their jobs. As experts in your fields, how do you respond to this criticism? Actually, you guys have become stealthy. You have stealthily become more accurate over the years, haven't you?
Yep.
And people don't give you credit for it.
Well, I prefer the crystal ball. I don't know if Brad likes the dartboard or...
We've got the wheel of death, we call it.
Yeah.
Because on big storms, you really have become incredibly accurate.
It's funny. We hear that joke all the time. And I know these guys at Channel 9 take it just as serious. We are all about accuracy. And the funny thing is, we track it. I have spreadsheets of our accuracy over the last year, and some of the statistics I can give you, with a 24-hour forecast, which is tomorrow's forecast, we get it right about 96.4% of the time. That's being within 3 degrees of our high and low.
How often are you surprised?
Not very often. Not very often. Sometimes it's the small details that particularly a meteorologist would care about that might catch us. But in the grand scheme of things for the larger public, it really won't make a difference to them on a day-to-day basis.
I have 30 seconds. Is Charlotte, and this is a great question, Charlotte in a pocket? A lot of times storms in summer or winter go around us and hit everybody else. Are we in a pocket? Is the downtown area keeping us warmer, cooler, et cetera, and warding off storms?
You know what? You can't really say on a small scale like that. Actually, the biggest factor for us would be the Appalachian Mountains causing changes to storm systems, and that can affect them downstream.
Neil, should everybody have a weather radio?
Absolutely. When I did the storm survey at Lake Burton, one of the things they said was the power went out 30 minutes ahead of the storm. There's only two ways you can get the information there, and that's when a battery-operated weather radio or a cell phone. So it's very important to have kind of a multi-layer way of receiving warning information.
Neil Dixon is general forecaster for the National Weather Service. Brad Panovich is chief meteorologist for WCNC 6 News. And Katie Virtue is a meteorologist with Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us.
Charlotte Talk.